From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The program is produced by Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. On the program today, Computers and You. Peter Kimball is our guest. He is with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers. For Peter, join us with a phone call or by email. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. And the email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Peter, good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
So it's a beautiful winter morning.
December already.
December 1st.
3 weeks and the days start getting longer.
That's a nice thing to think about, isn't it?
I was thinking about that.
Yeah. Yes. Speaking of nice things to think about, before we get into scary stuff about computers and security and privacy and all that kind of thing, I was wondering if you had seen anything lately that you thought was particularly well-designed, particularly useful. It could be an app. It could be a piece of machinery. What do you think?
Well, I continue to be impressed by how affordable storage space has become. Not only are hard disk drives incredibly cheap, although they've gone up a little bit since the flooding in Southeast Asia and Thailand, but solid-state hard drives are now becoming much more affordable in comparison and are incredibly fast. There are lots of nice little apps. My latest computer experience, maybe I'm late to the game with this, for various reasons, I'm driving a rental car at the moment, and it's got the Microsoft Sync interface with it, powered by Microsoft. It's a Ford vehicle. And it's actually quite a bit of information displayed to you and can tie into your phone, can tie into satellite transmissions, can do all sorts of interesting things.
So, but, and that would be good for, give us some
examples. Oh, that would be good. So it's almost like a heads-up display. It's so close to the windshield, you don't have to be looking down and fiddling around with, you know, controls on the radio. Among other things, this is a interesting aspect. I suppose it could be defeated, but by default, if you get in and you haven't buckled your seatbelt, it tells you, buckle your seatbelt to unmute the audio. There's no audio until your seatbelt is buckled.
Oh.
Which is kind of cool, especially if you have, you know, teenagers who haven't been conditioned to wear their seatbelts all the time. Other apps, I am exploring a number of applications, though it's not directly computer related, it is in a sense on the new smartphones. So the total of navigation, the total of being able to, a friend of mine just moved to a new location, and we actually drove there. It was in town, and as I got there, not only did the little navigation software get me there, but when we got there, because this is a street view city, all of a sudden it said, and here it is, and I had the photo of the place on my, you know, transmitted. Now, that's perhaps a little bit scary in terms of privacy, but basically it's Google driving along, you know, taking photos of places. So, interesting.
Yeah. What, well, what do you say we take a call?
All right.
All right. This is a listener in Belgium on line 4. Good morning.
Good morning to you all. As I'm sure in previous conversations with me, you found out that I'm not particularly computer literate. And I had an interesting experience here, and I've got a couple of questions about it. Last week, a little bit longer ago now, last week, I was listening to Focus in Taipei. It comes on about midnight and goes until 2 in the morning. And I was listening on it on an iPad. Now, iPads, my wife picked one up because she likes to do the internet sort of things. And the computer we had was getting pretty old and decrepit and didn't want to do what I wanted to do very well. And so instead of buying a computer, she said, I think I'll get an iPad. And it works out real well for that. Except, and here's where the question comes in. It's kind of difficult to work from a printer with it. Also, if you want to output anything from it to something else, like, you know, you can put, she can put her photos and stuff on it, but you can't output from that into a television like you could for some of the other things. Are there pieces of equipment that can make that go easier?
Well, that's a good question, and I'll do a little bit of research on it. Basically, with the iPads, you're limited because of the size of the device. You're limited to the number of connections. I believe that the iPad, although it may be only some models, have a USB output.
Now, this one has that little long, narrow little thing that Apple products have that plug into your computer that charges it and allows it to interface with your computer and
right.
iTunes, and a little button where you can put your hearing device into, like headphones, and that's it.
Yes, it's just got, I was just checking, it does not have the standard USB port. So there is likely to be, because that special 30-pin Apple proprietary connector to plug into the power supply and to computer for iTunes and all the other sorts of things, camera connections and whatnot, I am almost positive that given that, even though Apple is fairly proprietary about it, there will be third-party devices that can basically match whatever that particular connection needs and allow you to transfer. One option, if it can actually connect to your smartphone, is software on the smartphone that could allow you to transfer information back and forth.
Well, the way I understand it, there's iPad has one version that you can just get on the internet with. Then there's another one that has that capability for, like, you can put a smartphone in, you put a little card in it, makes you do all that stuff. And so I think you have to do, maybe that's the way you have to deal with it then.
I think that may be. It is partially a design consideration on the part of Apple to keep the size as small as possible, and it is partially a marketing consideration in terms of selling products and trying to keep people who are using the iPad connected more to the iTunes store and to the Apple App Store.
Apple community. And if I could ask one other question, I hope it's one thing. You just mentioned Street View.
Yes.
And it's interesting. Over here in Danville, we were one of the very first communities that were ever on Street View, as strange as it may sound. I think I could be wrong, but I think Street View technology was developed over there at the university, and then it was picked up by Google and moved throughout the world. And if I remember right, Danville was just beginning to work on its transportation system, buses and stuff, and they got a grant. And the fellow who was doing that came over here and started it in Danville. And as I happened to hear about it very early through a son who is savvy in those sort of things, and he said, "Dad, get on there and watch this." And over the years, it was amazing to watch Street View grow from here, Danville. It was on before Champaign was too.
Yes.
And just spread all over the world. It was an amazing sight to watch.
It is, and I know that they're tying that into mass transit districts a number of places as well already, of course, not with Street View particularly, but with general GPS applications and such. Champaign and other locales can give displays on at the various larger bus stops how long it will be until a particular route, a particular bus has arrived or will be arriving. And all of that is, of course, able to be integrated with Google Maps and with and therefore with Street View. So we're just seeing the very beginning of the way that's going to all develop.
It's been amazing to watch it. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Very welcome. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. I was doing some browsing the other day and discovered that one of the manufacturers now has a USB 3 adapter, that card, that will fit into a PSI slot, not a PSI Express. And I was wondering how successful that was going to be. It seemed rather improbable.
It should probably be able to give you nearly the full USB 3 speed. USB has basically a universal serial bus. It's an acronym, but everybody uses USB. Is basically a way that more and more devices are interconnected. As you probably well know, printers connect via USB. Keyboards and mice, if they're separate, can connect either wirelessly or through a USB. And it's gone through three major generations. The old original USB, which was just called USB, or 1.0 or 1.1, was quite slow, but did the job for keyboards and mice and printers and such. USB 2, which is on the vast majority of machines now, is considerably faster and is backwards compatible if you plug a USB 1 device into it. And USB 3 ups the ante considerably in terms of speed and capability, but still not so much that it wouldn't be able to be handled by a card, even if it's not going into the PCI Express bus. The bus speed is probably more than fast enough to handle anything currently that you would plug into USB 3 port that is itself USB 3 compatible. I don't think that would be the limiting factor in the speed. So it's a legitimate way of doing it.
I think it was supposed to give half the theoretical speed.
Which is still quite a bit more than USB 2. Because,
oh, my, yes.
Yes. But more and more computers, because the chipset is so inexpensive, more and more computers will just have as a standard the USB 3 port. And within a few years, that'll be the only thing that comes on computers.
I'm rather surprised it hasn't come in faster. USB 3 external hard drives are very reasonably priced and much, much faster than a USB 2. But when I was looking at the specs on computers the other day, at least three-quarters of them still had USB 2.
And that may partially be because of if the USB is going to be integrated into the motherboard, it will require not a major redesign, of course, but they may well have stock and inventory of chipsets that include the USB 2. There's not been a tremendous groundswell of demand for it, so I think it is, as you've noted, going to be a gradual phasing in. But it's certainly on the high-end machines now, and once things become more readily available and existing stocks are dealt with, it'll just migrate down to the lower end machines because it's no more expensive for a hardware manufacturer than USB 2.
No, the cards aren't very expensive. If you have a USB PCI Express system, the cards that go into it aren't much more expensive than the cards that go into or USB 2.
Right. But what's going to happen on most machines is it won't even take up a card slot. It'll simply be integrated into the motherboard.
Like our USB 2 is now.
Exactly. And that's what the delay is, probably.
I would think with the number of digital cameras around today that there would be more interest in it because it would certainly speed up the downloading of files from a camera.
Certainly in the case of digital video files, USB 2 is generally going to be fast enough for most people if they're just doing still images. All right, it may take 30 seconds instead of 5 seconds, but nonetheless.
Well, it takes me a little longer than that if I have 30 or 40 files to download in there, a full raw.
Well, yes, if you're dealing with
but
the raw
most people
format,
aren't doing that.
Exactly. And that's where the impetus is from the various manufacturers. So they'll bring it in. It'll be integrated into the motherboards on almost all systems, and that's just going to, because it will cost the manufacturers more to add a separate USB card and use up one of the ports. So they're going to resist doing that, even though it may only cost them an extra couple of bucks at the manufacturer's cost. So we'll see it as it starts being more widely used, as it starts being integrated into the basic motherboard, into the basic circuitry of the computer.
So the adapter for the PCI system would be okay, but probably try to find one that there are some reviews on it.
That's always a safe bet, find some reviews, although, as you say, it's probably okay. And though if it's not going in the PCI Express slot, certainly you're going to get a lot faster throughput than you would with the old USB 2.
Well, Well, the cost, it would keep my old computer going until perhaps the next version of Windows comes out.
Well, that could be an advantage. Of course, there's also always the question of, gee, I can now make this computer last for an extra year or two, so great, I was looking forward to getting a new one, but now this one's good for another couple of years. There's always a mix.
Well, I was looking around to see what was available. Thanks for the information.
You're quite welcome.
And now we've got an email question for you, Peter. I've heard previously on the show that you should remove hard drives from computers before recycling them. If so, what can be done to dispose of the hard drives if you don't want a bunch of old drives sitting around?
Well, the reason that the advice is to remove the hard drives is not because they're any more toxic or any more dangerous if landfilled than any other component that's in the computer. It's not like they've got the lithium batteries in it. The reason is because unless you take fairly specific and out-of-the-ordinary steps, information on that hard drive is still available. And even if erased, there are traces left and it can be recovered. Now, not many people are going to really admittedly go to the trouble of doing that, but the reason for taking it out is so that it could then be destroyed, so that it could not be read. And once you've destroyed it and you can use the brute force approach, you can take it out and then whack it with a hammer a few times, wear eye protection if you do that. Then you can just send it off to the computer recycling next time there's an electronics recycling, just as with the computer. It is also possible, and there is software available for download for both Windows and Mac machines, and this might be more useful for notebooks where it's a little bit more difficult to remove the hard drive, that will do a secure wipe and erase of the hard drive. Basically, it does it by overwriting it a whole bunch of times. It takes quite a while. Either of those alternatives, for example, physical destruction of the hard drive, or a secure erasing program that meets certain specifications are acceptable ways that the university accepts for deleting potentially sensitive information from computers before it is disposed of or even sent to surplus.
Okay. I hope that helps the listener. And now we're going to take another telephone call. This is Champaign County, Line 2. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about external hard drive. I put a hard drive. It's an old IEE, I guess. I don't know. It's not the most. I stuck it in an enclosure for specifically, I guess, designed for a optical drive. Now, some computers recognize it as a hard drive, but my parents' XP at home does not. It wants me to insert a disk. So I'm wondering if that's a hardware assignation of some sort, or whether those tabs on the back of the hard drive, or it's on the enclosure, whether there's some way to help the computers recognize what it's seeing, whether there's a software mounting program that would recognize it, or is there any way to make that happen?
When you put in the hard drive, and basically you've got it occupying the slot that would have been an optical drive.
I'm sorry. This was in the enclosure. It's a USB.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. It is a USB. It's an external hard drive.
Yeah, it's in an enclosure that was actually designed for an optical drive.
Ah, okay.
Some computers recognize it as a hard drive right out of the box. At least a couple have. And then an older XP Windows machine needs a little help, and I'm wondering whether there is any kind of help, or whether that's a hardware.
Well, it's probably not exclusively hardware. Basically, what would be happening, I understand the scenario now, you've got a external power supply in a box that was originally meant for an optical drive, and you've got a physical hard drive in it, and when you plug it in, some computers recognize that it is a hard drive and your XP box doesn't. So that is one of two things. There are, but it probably can be dealt with software. What you will need to try to find is the appropriate driver software. That's basically the difference between the newer machines and what XP is doing. XP, the driver is simply looking at a setting, and it may well be some of the switches on the enclosure that you're using, and you would have to look up the documentation for that. It should be available from the manufacturer's website. But it may also be necessary to perhaps from that same manufacturer's website to find an updated driver program. That's the software that sits between the Windows system and the actual piece of hardware. So there are drivers for hard drives. There are drivers for USB devices. There are drivers for screens and mice and all the rest. So a more specific driver that would be a bit more updated rather than the generic one that came with your Windows XP might be able to handle that external USB connection and recognize that it is a hard drive. So it should be solvable with software. It may require looking up the switch settings.
Okay. I guess that'll...
But it's not insoluble. You just may have to hunt around a little bit to get the right combination. But it is
as
definitely...
You mentioned the price of hard drives is such that maybe it's not worth my time to mess with it.
Well, I was thinking that, but I wasn't going to really say it. Especially, although prices have gone up, but the last time I checked before the Thailand floods, a 2 terabyte, that is 2,000 gigabyte hard drive, was under $100.
Right. So, right. And this is only 500 gigs. So.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Good luck.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. Other telephone calls are welcome. Email messages as well. You can join us this morning with a phone call or by email. The phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. My name is Celeste Quinn, and this is Focus. On the program today, Computers and You, Peter Kimball is back with us this month. He is with the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Well, what would you like to talk about now? We've got a little break. No email coming in at the moment.
Okay.
No phone calls.
Well, something that kind of tickled my fancy. I became aware of a new acronym lately. Everybody knows about spam.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also now something that's referred to as, well, it's bland automated community notification, or BAC, and pronounced bacon as opposed to spam. Spam mail is unsolicited, but bacon is basically... email that you have signed up for, but you might want to read sometime, but maybe not. You're going to get it right away. And more people have a whole lot of that. I know I get a lot of so-called bacon. So it might be news alerts, messages from merchants that you've dealt with, newsletters from your bank, etc. That it's not exactly unsolicited, so you can't call it spam, but it's a second cousin. So, a new term for the in the vernacular. I've got a lot of spam, but some bacon too.
Some bacon too. All right.
So,
I've got some time now. I'm going to look through the bacon.
Yes, and it's I keep going through and trying to cut down on the amount of bacon I get because it's not good to eat too much or have too much bacon, I suppose.
That's right. That's right.
We probably ought to talk, since the holiday season is coming up, about a recurrent kind of spam and, or not spam, but phishing attempts to get somebody's private information. And the most common one that's coming out in the last couple of weeks purports and looks to be like a message from UPS saying, UPS message, your package was not deliverable.
Mm-hmm.
Click here. And as so many people are ordering things online, and UPS is, of course, one of the typical delivery services, that can oftentimes entice people to click on links that they would not otherwise check, especially since some of these are now, the phishing messages are what are generally sending out a message and trying to get somebody to respond to it. But spear phishing, another term, is a more directed approach. So these messages from UPS may actually have your name on them, which is fairly easily done because they've got your email address. If they're sending it to you, and oftentimes you can pull, an email address from that. And so the advice is if you get one of these messages, and that isn't necessarily only from UPS, it could be from the U.S. Postal Service, it could be from FedEx, it could be from any number, you need to check and be very careful that any link that you hover over before you click it really is going to take you to something like UPS.com or FedEx.com, or perhaps even better yet, if you're suspicious about it, is go to your browser and just type in FedEx or UPS directly and then enter the tracking number. But there are a large number of these messages, and this is the time of the year when there mm-hmm. tend to be even more.
Yeah, and as we know, people are doing a lot more business
they
online.
They are doing an incredible amount.
A lot more shopping, so those packages have to come to the door.
They have to come to somebody's door. Yeah, I mean, the online experience is only for the buying. It has to be delivered.
Yeah.
So,
let's take another call. This is a listener in Aurora. Line 4, hi.
Hi. Yes, I just got a virus on my computer that I had to have removed, and I wasn't too happy about what it cost me. And I'm running Microsoft Essentials. And, you know, the guy that set it up for me said that it was good, and I'm just wondering what your opinion is. Is there something better out there or what?
Well, Microsoft Essentials is good. There are several other programs. Many of them are perhaps slightly better in some respects. There are reviews of a number of the antivirus programs that appear periodically on sites like CNET, .com, and elsewhere. Of course, if nobody really knows how they got a virus, because if you had known in advance, you would not have taken whatever steps. But one of the most typical ways, of course, is visiting a website that is maliciously designed or has been hacked and is going to try to download something, or trying to view an online video, something that purports to be something like from YouTube, where it says, well, you need to download this particular program to be able to view it. It requires a new viewing program, etc. Most of the antivirus programs will be able to deal with that. I'm assuming that you have your Windows machine set so that you are automatically getting the Windows updates, which is step one. There are several other antivirus and firewall protection programs out there. Some of them are probably a bit more robust than Microsoft Essentials. However, if you do look at the reviews for some of those, what you'll want to be sure to do is that you do not try running two antivirus programs, Microsoft Essentials and something else, at the same time. Two, in this case, is much worse than one because they will get into each other's way and will slow your system down considerably.
Okay. Because I do have, on my laptop, I have AVG, which, you know, I really don't know what your opinion is on AVG. This is the problem. The one I have Microsoft Essentials on is my desktop.
Right. AVG gets tolerably decent reviews. I haven't really looked at the reviews lately. It has certainly got the advantage that it is, if it's not entirely free, it's certainly nearly so.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some advantages in some of the subscription offerings. The general experience seems to be that some of the subscriber options that are not free and may have an initial cost of $40 or $50 and an annual renewal cost of, you know, $20, $30, $40, depending on how many computers you're protecting, they tend to be updated a bit more often and have a larger staff that may deal with trying to keep updated appraisals of what various threats that are out there. None of them are really going to protect you from the so-called zero-day threats, which are exploits, security vulnerabilities that become apparent and immediately start being exploited before there's a chance to send out a patch, for example, for whatever the problem is. But in general, my advice, my personal preference is I go with a subscription service, and then the question becomes, look at the reviews. It is not only the amount of protection that you get, but how much of a load does it put on your system. One software package that I was using tended to really hog the CPU and slow things down more so than others. So that's another factor to consider when you're looking at the reviews. I'm somewhat loath to recommend specific products.
I've noticed. Yeah. Well, now, is there any programs that you could run once in a while to to check your computer out to be, see if there is anything on there? Is there anything that you would recommend under that category?
Well, almost all of the antivirus programs have an option not only to detect things as they come in, but they have a scan function that can actually, typically I'll set mine to run, you know, at midnight or whenever, and they actually will do that exact same function. So the scanning of what's currently installed for all sorts of threats is integrated into many of those software packages, including, I believe, AVG. Microsoft Essentials, I don't know. I don't use it, but it may have. But there are certainly a number of basically you're looking at an antivirus program that has built into it a scanning function.
Right, and I'm looking at my Microsoft Essentials right now, and it does have that, you know, that scan you can set.
Yes, which you should set. Generally, if it's well done, it won't tie up your computer too badly, but if you set it to run at a time that your computer is going to be on and you're not necessarily going to be using it, then it's
You just brought up an interesting question. Your computer needs to be on for this to run that scan, does it?
That is correct.
Because I see mine set for 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning, and I have to admit that my computer most times is not on at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning.
Well, sometimes the software, depending on the settings, will say, well, if it's, you know, if it's past that time and I don't have a record that I've run the scan within the last week, I'll run it at some other time. But it's also possible that it just never actually does the scan if your machine is off.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your help today.
Well, good luck. Sorry about your virus, but glad you got rid of it.
Thanks for the call. This is Focus on the program today. We're talking about computers with Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn, and this is Focus, and we'll have more in a moment.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Natural Gourmet. Natural Gourmet is a natural food store specializing in vitamin supplements, homeopathic remedies, and organic foods. Located at the Shops of Knollwood, their restaurant features Thai-influenced foods for eat-in or carry-out.
And before we get back to our conversation with you, our listeners, and Peter Kimball, I've got a couple of announcements to pass on to you this morning. Gary Nell is officially today on board as the new CEO of NPR, and as part of his first day on the job, he is going to be a guest on Talk of the Nation. So today, WILL will preempt the 1 o'clock hour broadcast of Fresh Air in favor of carrying Talk of the Nation. Gary Nell will join host Neil Conan for a conversation with NPR listeners about NPR's role in media and the future direction of public radio. So you'll want to tune in to that today at 1 o'clock, Talk of the Nation. You can hear Fresh Air later today at 7 p.m. here on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. And WILL AM 580 will be off the air tomorrow, December 2nd, from 9 a.m. until about 1 p.m. while our transmitter power supply is connected to the University of Illinois' underground utility. This phase of our tower work will help make AM 580 more reliable during bad weather. We apologize for this interruption to our service and thank you for your patience throughout the tower repair project this fall. AM 580 programming will be available online tomorrow at will.illinois.edu. And again, that's tomorrow, December 2nd, from 9 a.m. until about 1 p.m. So Focus will bring you some archive programs. I will be doing the noon hour, the afternoon magazine, live as usual. So do join us at will.illinois.edu. So we're back now with Peter Kimball. And listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. And I'm going to bring up a new email here, Peter, so
all right,
as I get a hold of it here. Okay, this is a good question. Some very lucky kids are getting an iPod Touch and an iPad for Christmas. The listener wants to know, do I need virus protection?
Well, that is a good question. The iPod touch and the iPad in particular, because they are relatively limited to what you can download from basically the Apple Store, there is not a lot of vulnerability there. I'm going to check and see what is my recommendation would be. It's not a technology that I use, so I, though I'm a staunch believer in certainly having antivirus programs on Mac desktop and laptop systems because they are vulnerable, although there aren't as many viruses and malicious software targeted towards them. But I believe that the iPod and the iPad are going to be a little bit more protected simply by their very nature. And I'm going to see what we've got here. And there's actually a discussion here at the Apple support community asking whether that's necessary. And the response, now this is from a from about a year or so ago, but the response from Apple is the iPod does not allow downloads except from iTunes or the App Store. And the App Store is pretty thoroughly vetted. Anything that is installed there is checked by Apple. That's both a benefit and a criticism because, A, you will have applications that are probably fairly safe, but, B, it may stifle innovation. So one could argue on either side of that. But the iPad also does not allow background processes and multitasking to go on. So I would say the answer is no.
Okay, very good. Let's take a call. This is a listener waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You had noticed some reluctance to recommend a particular product, so I thought I'd ask you about a particular product and give me a
okay.
thumbs up or a thumbs down without any particular comment. But for a couple of years since I lost a hard drive to a virus, I've been using subscription to Norton 360.
Uh-huh.
And you had mentioned that some of those things aren't up to date, but it has a feature called Live Update.
Yes.
And it insists that you run that on a pretty regular basis. And since I've been using that, they give you a monthly report, and it says tells you how many intrusions they've stopped, and it's in the 100,000s sometimes on my laptop. And I just wondered if you'd give me a plus or minus on Norton 360.
It's well regarded. The hundreds of thousands of intrusion attempts, that's defining things very loosely. That doesn't mean that, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of attempts to hijack your machine. But the live update, certainly any modern antivirus program, the live update or the ability of continuing to update the definitions is essential these days. The case of, you know, once a week or once a month or long past once a day, the antivirus software that I use may typically have updates four or five times a day. And so that is very much advisable and is not unique to Norton, the fact that they, to really use it effectively, you must accept those live updates. I just let it run in the background. And certainly some of those thousands of intrusions may be legitimate to be concerned about. Gee, if I hadn't had this, it may have caused me problems. But most of them, it's even going to count things as installing tracking cookies and such, which are annoying but relatively harmless, are in that total. So visit one website,
yeah,
and you may have 50 or 60 or 100 different so-called attempts at intrusion, but they're not really. It depends on the definition. So they're not misleading you directly, but they are exaggerating things to make sure, I suppose, that you keep subscribing to them.
Yeah, one thing that it does provide you also in the monthly review is relating to cookies, provides you with a list that gives you the name of the cookie and the action that Norton has taken.
Yes.
To block it, and then it gives you a rating as to whether that cookie was really harmful or a serious problem.
Well, and the cookies in and of themselves do not do damage. It's a privacy issue, and so it's not that a cookie is going to take over your computer or cause a virus to be installed, but it does allow your browsing history, the sites that you visit, and such to be tracked. And sometimes that's done by third parties who are the advertising partners of various websites. And so there is some concern there. And some cookies are known from their company affiliation, DoubleClick and others, that they are definitely ad and tracking cookies for the sole purpose of trying to determine where you are and what should be marketed to you. And those are probably going to be caught and deleted by Norton, for example. My antivirus program does much the same thing, gives me reporting of all of these. Cookies are, however, sometimes useful. Those cookies can store the information if you have a particular site that you go to, a news site, for example, or some other site, and you've set your preferences in such a way. The only way that site is going to recognize you and restore your preferences is to look at the little ID number that's in the cookie and then bring that information up saying, oh, so-and-so wants to have, you know, this and that and the other thing displayed and not these other features. So you can certainly go ahead.
I have my Google web browser set to erase all cookies when I close the browser, and my speed is such that not storing cookies doesn't ever seem to be a problem loading anything.
No, it shouldn't be a problem loading things. It just may be that some websites forget that you've been there before.
I see.
For example, one example is there is one way that some banks do security is they will take a fingerprint of your computers, the hard drive and all the rest, so they can detect if you're using a different machine. And part of that information, not the primary information, is stored in a cookie. And if that's not there, you may find that that banking website, the next time you go to it, says, well, hi, I know you say you're this, but we need to double check to make sure you're really who you say you are. And it goes into the secondary security questions. That may be sometimes at some sites a result of clearing all cookies.
Yeah,
no harm done, but it's just could be slightly annoying or a little bit more time consuming.
So I hadn't actually thought about that being a result of clearing all the cookies, but thanks for that information. Thanks a lot for taking my call, and appreciate your information.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus. We're talking about computers today with Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois. We've got about 8 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to join us, give us a call or drop us an email, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Another email question, Peter. I have a Mac and am running the McAfee antivirus software that I got through the U of I web store. I recently upgraded to Apple's newest operating system, OS X Lion, and now my antivirus software isn't working. Are you aware of any compatibility problems between McAfee and Lion?
Not specifically, but I know that there are many software issues with the new Lion operating system. Several programs that used various techniques that ran fine on the previous versions from Snow Leopard and all back, although I think they're going to run out of cat names eventually. There are several programs, especially those that have to have their connections deep within the operating system, such as an antivirus program. There is enough difference with Lion that several of those programs no longer function. McAfee will no doubt have an updated version at some point because they, of course, want to keep the Macintosh market viable. But the best bet would be to go to the McAfee website and explore the options there and see what they say. And once it's become available, it will be available through the university in relatively short order. Okay. But yes, there are definitely known incompatibilities with older software with the new Macintosh operating system.
Is there currently an antivirus software option for Lion?
I suspect that there are. I would have to do a quick little check here.
Sure.
And the whether or not, in the case of the particular person who wrote this email, there may not be anything offered yet through the university, but antivirus software is relatively inexpensive anyway.
And it's one of those things that I don't think you want to be without, right?
It is definitely something you don't want to be without. Macs are, as we've said a number of times before, though they are not targeted as often, they are starting to be targeted more and more with antivirus. And also, that one of the problems is it may not, in addition to antivirus or malicious software attacks, viruses and other things going after the operating system, they also go after things like flash files, Adobe Acrobat documents, which if you're displaying on your Mac, you could certainly have a problem that way. Yes, there are several antivirus software packages listed for the Mac OS Lion. And so if the emailer just does a search for something like Mac Lion antivirus software, and I might throw in after that reviews to kind of compare them, but there are several different things here.
Yeah. Boy, I think McAfee would be on this by now.
Well, and they may be. It may simply be that the other thing that the emailer should check is to see from the U of I web store, which is where he would have gotten his McAfee through the U of I, if indeed they have a new version that can be downloaded, because that may well already be there, and he's just running the old version, which certainly does not have compatibility with Lion.
Okay, very good. Well, I hope that helps our listener. And we've got a couple of minutes left here in this portion of the program. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the phone numbers, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Anything you wanted to say?
Well, yeah, let me toss out one other thing. This was brought to mind by the caller asking about cookies. There are some other techniques that websites can use to store information not in cookies, so deleting your cookies does not clear that information out. Sometimes generically these are called super cookies. And one of the fairly common ways of dealing with of storing that information is through flash enabled websites, because Adobe Flash, and almost everybody has the Adobe Flash Player installed, can also store basically the equivalent of cookies, but they're not stored in the same place. And so deleting all your cookies will not get rid of the Flash cookies. It's fairly easy to get rid of them, but it's not quite the same as going into the browser and saying delete all cookies. That won't do it. The best way, without giving a big long web address, is do a search for Flash cookie removal. And there will be a number of sites there that link to the actual Adobe site. Well, it's the Macromedia site, the company that Adobe took over. And from that site, you can actually change your settings and say, I want to delete all my Flash cookies. I do not want to allow Flash cookies to be stored in the future. So it's actually a website that you'd be able to get to fairly easily just by doing a search for Flash cookie removal. And that way you could add another level of protection. A number of companies are using those Flash cookies to basically respawn or recreate regular cookies if you come back and visit. Perhaps less than 100% ethical companies are doing that.
But okay. One more call this morning. Charleston, line one. Hi.
Hi. I just have a kind of a broad question. It seems to me that the progression of computer hardware these days is moving towards trying to make everything into smaller, less moving parts. And I was wondering if you know, if you think that's a good thing, because I've always sort of been more of a desktop user than a laptop user, and I probably always will be. How do you think that will affect the progression of, you know, technology and hardware? And are you for it or are you against it? I'm going to hang up. Thank you very much.
The simple answer is I am for it. The fewer moving parts, the more reliable it's going to be. Eventually, as prices come down, the more affordable it will be, although currently solid-state hard drives are more expensive than moving disk hard drives. Ultimate in reliability and in longevity will be with fewer moving parts. There was a quote from, I'm thinking it was probably Isaac Asimov, a visionary and science fiction and science writer, who in one of his stories had the ultimate goal, no machine may have any moving parts. So my answer is yes, it's great.
Okay, very good. Any last word, Peter? We've got about a minute left.
Well, everybody should certainly enjoy the holidays, but be safe with all the shopping online.
Yes.
Don't do foolish clicking here because I got this email that says I need to clear up some delivery issue. Just in the excitement and the thrill of the chase, if you will, for online shopping, don't get careless.
Right.
That would be one bit of advice. But at the same time, don't let the concerns about, is it safe to go online, you know, put a damper on the season.
Yeah, you'll never leave the house, right?
You'll never leave the house. Well, and, you know, if you're traveling, there are certain safe, if with your computer, there are certain safety things you could do. Don't go to some strange place and log on to check your bank account. That would probably be a good idea. But it is certainly an exciting time to be looking at all the new technology, which has become more affordable. It's becoming much more easily usable. It's having fewer moving parts. And that's about all that I really have to say.
Well, it's so good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Yes.
And happy holidays.
Happy holidays. I guess I will see you again in February in 2012,
that?
Which is a leap year and a leap month.
Oh, okay. Very good.
So let's come around again.
All right. Peter Kimball is with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. And this has been our monthly look at computers.